Welcome back. Welcome back to the Grapevine. We are in the studio. We on a good, nice, clean studio here in the Grapevine, the Truth Radio 101.7 studios. This is we're going to have a really good segment today, and we're going to pick some grapes too. So I'm going to get right to it because we don't got a lot of time. And I wish we had a lot of time, like at least 5-6 hours. We ain't got that much time because everybody needs to go to sleep. But welcome to The Truth, the award-winning 101.7 The Truth Radio. And before we begin, today's going to be a different type of show. And I want you all to sit up for this because we got a lot to talk about on this show in a short amount of time. We're going to talk about what's broken in this city. Today, I got somebody in this building that doesn't just talk about it, but she is about it. 15 years addiction, 11 plus years sober. And instead of just quiet healing and moving on with her life, she built Samad's house. 3 sober living homes, a behavior health clinic. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. And a harm reduction agency as well.
And that number could always go up because there's need in our city. There's need in our communities. There's also need in the state, the country, internationally. There's need everywhere for that. In particular, Black residents are dying at an alarming rate. So it's double the rate of white residents.
Absolutely. What we're seeing is that although there is a decline in drug overdose deaths, it doesn't hold true with our Black and brown communities. There's still a huge disparity of overdose deaths within our communities.
So we have on our... To formally introduce my guest, we have Tahir Malik and Byron. What's your last name?
Thompson.
And I'm happy. I'm excited that we're doing this interview because accidents, you know, this is not an accident. This is something that has been, you've been raised to do this.
In essence, I would believe so, because I come from a very strong family of yes. Bringing community involvement. That has always been the background of my family. First off, I'd like to thank you, Manon, for inviting me to come to the Grapevine and to be able to spread some awareness. To the world of substance use, recovery, harm reduction, and fitness. I invited Byron Thompson on because not only, so we do harm reduction, we do sober living, and we do behavioral health. But when you come into recovery, you have to learn yourself again. You have to find out what you like and what you don't like. You are essentially a new person, okay? And then you also have to learn how to relive life.
Yeah.
Soberly. So the family events, concerts, sports events, you probably did it inebriated. And that's what made it so fun. So you thought. But you have to learn how to do those things in a sober frame of mind. In the Phoenix, Milwaukee, Byron Thompson,
yeah,
that is what they teach. That is what they promote. And so I'll hand it over to Byron so he can give you a little background about what the Phoenix, Milwaukee does.
Tell me.
Thank you for having me, Manon.
And this is a conversation, hey, man, look.
Yeah. Okay. Well, really, like, it's an honor to be on the show and to talk about this and to, you know, be talking about it with a great partner of the Phoenix, which is Samad's house in Tahira. I mean, we're like, you know, just as she said, you know, she brings the people in, shelters them, detoxes, gets the drugs and stuff out of their system.
Right.
And we work hand in hand because, you know, once they get that, you know, once they get, you know, a roof over their head and, you know, Friday comes around and paycheck comes around and life comes around, then that's where we come in. You know, what am I going to do on Friday night?
Mm.
How am I going to you know what I mean? As a person myself in long-term recovery, mm-hmm. I thought life was over 25 years ago when I wasn't going to be able to get a check, go to the bar, play some hoop, smoke some weed. I mean, all that stuff was just programmed into me. And I was like, what am I going to do?
You said 25 years.
25 years, yeah. September 13th will be 26 years of sobriety right here in Milwaukee. And I got sober right where I got high on Chambers and Holton. I ended up just making a decision to get sober and do it right here in Milwaukee. So I'm definitely talking about something I know about and finding something, you know, everything must change when you get into this lifestyle. Everything must change. Your friends, your associates, where you go, what you do. But it also helps you rediscover some of the loves that you had. I forgot when I was out there using that I was also kind of a pretty good basketball player. Good, you know, I like to, you know, I'm still social, still fun, but I need to be around like-minded people that's on the way positive. And I think that's what the Phoenix does. We provide, you know, an alternative to the partying lifestyle. And we do it, you know, the Bucks game,
mm-hmm.
the Brewers game. We take people to their first Bucks game, their first Brewer game, their first sober tailgate. We make that experience for people, and we do it for free.
Tell me about the sober conscious, sober living movement that you all are spearheading. Because I've heard about it, and I do it because I'm sober. But you first started hearing about it in maybe about 6 years ago, ultimately on a national scale from me. That's from my perspective, mm-hmm. right? But I'm sure it's been there forever. But in Milwaukee, you all are at the spear tip of this entire sober conscious, sober living movement. Tell me, how did that get started?
Well, I can speak from my perspective, Manon. I've been in recovery for 14 years now from opioids. And my motto has always been, and I know, Manon, you've seen me in addiction.
Mm-hmm.
You saw me through that phase. And I want everyone to always know, I'm going to recover as loudly as I was when I was in addiction. Because I need people to understand that recovery is possible. Mm-hmm. For me, when I was ready to recover, I didn't know where I could go to begin that process. And ultimately, it led me into incarceration. And that's where I became sober.
Mm-hmm.
See, I already had the mindset that I wanted to become sober. I just didn't know how to do it. And unfortunately, jail provided that space for me, or fortunately it did, because had that not happened, I may not be sitting before you today as the founder of Samad's House. Once you come into sobriety, mm-hmm. like Byron said, you have to change. It's that trifecta area, your mind, body, and spirit. They all go hand in hand. You have to change that mindset. You have to learn to love your body and yourself again. You have to change and grow within your own spirituality, knowing that something greater than yourself saved you.
Yeah.
And knowing that you have the power to go back out there to let people know that they also have the power to change their life if that's what they want to do. But once you change your life, it doesn't mean that now that you come into sobriety, you have to be boring. Mm-hmm. If you know me, I love to laugh. Mm-hmm. I love fun. Mm-hmm. So when I was introduced to the Phoenix, it was a no-brainer for me. You know, it's because it's like, I love music. Yeah. Let's do this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the first experience for me was Soberfest. Now, Soberfest is going into its sixth year.
Yeah.
And I've been around. This is going on my third year of Soberfest.
Yeah.
And Soberfest is the largest sober concert here in Milwaukee County.
Wow.
I venture to say Wisconsin. I venture to say Wisconsin.
In the Midwest.
Yes.
In the Midwest.
And what Soberfest is, it's all of the recovery community coming together at the Pierre Marquette Park, listening to some great music, eating some great food.
Yep.
And just networking and having fun.
How and we have a few seconds before we hit our first break, but how important is instant gratification in this whole scheme of things? Because having an instant hit can change your life in many different forms. Instant, you know, you can shoot a basketball, boom. And, you know, that's that instant bang, that hit. And then you have an instant high, which could bring you up and then way back down.
Yes.
And then you kind of want to go back up again. Yes. How important is it to work through those barriers of instant gratification? When we come back.
I wanted to go there.
We can go there. When we come back on the Great Vibe, we're going to pick some more greats with Tahir and Byron. Back into. Welcome back to the Grapevine. I was about to say something real like poetic.
Like poetry.
Right. Yeah, this is my poetry now. Welcome back to the Grapevine. I'm your host, Manan Sabir, and we are about to pick some more grapes with Tahir Malik and Byron Thompson. Tahir Malik is the founder of Samad's House, and Byron Thompson is also the founder of, am I right?
No, I'm actually senior manager.
Senior manager.
Yeah, with the Phoenix.
Of the Phoenix. And we're talking sober living. And I wanted to ask you a question, Tahir, and this is for knowledge for the folks that are around us. Your parents were married for how long?
55 years.
I have to mention this because
55 years. I don't think they make marriages like that anymore.
55.
Did you know that?
I didn't know.
It would be 55. Such a blessing to find your soulmate.
Mm-hmm.
You know how rare that is? Mm-hmm. And to I think we as individuals actually give up too easily on our relationships.
Yeah.
We don't work through the tough stuff.
Yeah. It builds muscle. Mm-hmm. It builds power, muscle, finesse. Like it builds those attributes within the marriage. What did you learn? And you probably answered this, but going through that period of time. And even you, how long were your parents married?
Man, over 50 years, for sure.
What did you both learn? This is a dual question. When looking at their prosperity and struggles and also triumphs up to death, right? What did you learn moving through your addictions and you looked at your parents like, there's something there, right? What was there that kept you, what was there in their relationship that kept you going?
For me, first off, compromise is essential in any relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, there's going to be a give and there's going to be a take. My mom was always that loving, nurturing, listening ear that you could tell her anything and she will help you problem solve through that. My dad, you know, I I was raised in a very strict household.
Right.
You know,
I see listening.
That makes two of us.
There's for me, and this may be why it's so hard for me to maintain a relationship. There are direct roles I was raised in that a man does and a woman does. Right.
Right now, I'm telling y'all, she ain't looking right now. I'm just saying, she's just saying this. All right. There's a process.
This is just my background and my upbringing.
Right.
Not saying it whether it's right or it's wrong, but this is how I was raised.
Yeah.
And even though I felt that my dad was very, very strong, I couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
Anybody who was raised around us, I couldn't sit on the porch. I was the first girl. It was like, no.
Oh, yeah.
Oh no. No, no, no.
They're not going to say the block, but yeah.
They're going to say like, oh no, you are not going to talk to my child. You are not talking to my daughter. So I couldn't get off the porch. No, I couldn't. And as an adult, I understand it.
Yeah.
As an adult, I now understand the values and the beliefs that my parents instilled in me. And mm-hmm. those were the roots that mm-hmm. put me up out of addiction.
Yeah, they were right all along, actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
We found out.
Absolutely. And I'm going to say this. Even through my father being very strict, he's always been my Superman.
Oh, yeah.
He is the one man I know I can call at any point in time of my life.
Yeah.
And he's going to show up. And if he says something, he means it.
And it might not be the way you like it. He might not handle it the way you like it. I thought it was gonna be turn out to be this whole rosy, picturesque scene. Nah, he might make it a little ugly. Yeah. I mean, or it might not be ugly. It might be real rosy, but it's not the way you put it. It's the way he connected with God in order to make sure that things happen that way.
Yeah, I heard all my life I was higher headed.
You heard that too?
Come on, man. My dad was a law enforcement officer. You know what I'm saying? So, like, you couldn't do nothing. I mean, he didn't believe not one word because he worked with, you know. Guys who lied all the time. So I'm 6 years old. He got a light bulb over my head asking me questions. No, it didn't happen like that. That ain't the way it happened.
He trained you young.
Interrogations began early. But I would say that what I learned from my parents was that things that are glorified, things that I watched on TV and at the movies, the flashiness and stuff like that, that I was super drawn to the guys in the neighborhood who had the this and the that, you know. I mean, my parents' kind of consistency was never celebrated. I never saw that at the theater, you know, getting up, going to work every day, coming home, staying with your family, taking care of your, you know, I never, you know, all the people that I was seeing that looked like us on the screens when I was growing up was hustling and doing and I didn't even need to do that, but I wanted to do that. You know, they were bringing that home to us, but we was wanting to, you know, struggle. You know what I mean? Because that was more exciting. And consistency is something that I didn't get until I got into recovery. Like, hey, I gotta do this every day. This is not just 30 days. This is my whole lifestyle. So don't rush because it's a lifetime. I got to do this every single day.
And that brings me to, like, what did your family have to relearn about trusting you again? Was there a moment where you weren't sure that that the trust wouldn't come back?
It took a lot of work. It took a lot of work because I did a lot of questionable things and things that I was raised to not do. Right.
Yeah.
And for me, it wasn't just me having my parents relearn me or be able to trust me again. That was huge, right? Mm-hmm. But also my siblings, right? But then also my community. Because before I fell into addiction, I worked in a community.
Yeah.
and I did questionable things as a leader in a community, right? Mm-hmm. So it was major for me to not only regain the trust of my family, but also the trust of the community. And that's part of the reason why I go so hard, mm-hmm. because I need the community to understand that I understand the depths of what I did, mm-hmm. and I'm willing to reinvest in yep. the community that I once tore down.
Yeah.
I would say that, you know, like you talk about instant gratification, it doesn't come, that trust doesn't come back instantly. And I remember a time when I was up here in Milwaukee, I'm originally from Chicago, that I went back home you know, I was dressed real nice. I was, you know, I don't know how much clean time I had, but I was really walking in, kind of, you know, my chest pumped out, I thought I had made it, and my dad was like, "No, man, we seen this movie before." You know what I mean? And he really like kind of shot me down, and I was really like, "Damn, you know, I'm not there yet." And I never went back to him again, trying to. I just let the time. I let the time pass, and when I had made it, then he came to me.
Yeah.
And was like, "Man, I see you. You know, you're doing it. You're doing, you know." But I never rushed back into him and tried to, like, impress. I just waited. You know, I just kept my head down and worked until it was evident that I was on the right path. You know.
So what's one thing about what's one thing about recovery nobody warns you about before you start?
That it's easier. Living in recovery is easier than living in addiction. I tell you wow. that. Living in recovery is so much easier than living in addiction. I was addicted to opioids, so that was a physical sickness.
Yeah.
If I didn't have that substance, I was physically sick. Mm-hmm. Every bone in my body hurt. I couldn't get up and prepare my children for school because I was in too much pain. I got to figure out how to get some money and how to get this substance. Mm-hmm. All of those different things and all of this plotting and scheming.
Did they see you go through it?
Who, my children?
The kids.
My oldest daughter did. My oldest daughter did. And I thought I had did the best thing by allowing her at 6 to go and live with her father. Mm-hmm. She did that for about 5 years. But what came from that, because I had 2 younger children, mm-hmm. was that she felt a sense of abandonment. Mm-hmm. She asked, "You have them. Why didn't you keep me?" I thought I was doing the best thing because I was struggling. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally struggling. And she and I had to work through that, through counseling. And we still work through that, you know. Because I love my children, mm-hmm. you know. Outside of my parents helping me, I've been a single mother all my life.
Yeah.
So I'm blessed to have such great and wonderful parents and such a supportive family.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something that they don't tell you is that this the secret benefits of sobriety, you know. the things that you don't, you know, you're just trying to get your car back and your job back and your house back, and one of the greatest things that I didn't realize that was going to come with sobriety was just being there, you know, just being available for your family, you know, being, you know, somebody is definitely going to pass away, mm-hmm. somebody is going to need, they're going to need you to just go pick somebody up from the airport, and we can get in touch with Byron. Mm-hmm. You know, we know his number's good. You know, my mom used to tell me, she used to write my phone number in pencil, you know, because mm-hmm. of all of the moves I was making and moving from side to side of town, getting put out of this and this and that, and just my instability. And so, you know, when I was needed, when my dad got sick in 2017, you know, they just called me and said, "Byron, we need you to come, you know." And I had a job that, you know, I had been working, and they gave me time to go. But I didn't think about all of that when I was just trying to get stuff back, you know. that availability is just, you know, it's just a super blessing. And I also know where my car is and all that other stuff. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? You know what I mean? It's not, they're not coming to take my stuff. You right. know what I mean? Like they always were, you know, back when we were out there.
They're not coming to take my stuff, or I'm not trying to sell my stuff.
Wait. I never did that, though. No, I'm just
hey, we're going to come right back. We're going to come right back on the grapevine with you here, Byron. We're going to dig into some passion, the passion around Samad's house and the Phoenix when we come back in two.
Life's better with American Family Insurance because we know you love working weekends.
Glad we're back. I'm super happy we're back. I'm super happy, super happy, super happy. This is The Grapevine. I'm your host, Manon Sabir, on 101, the award-winning 101.7 The Truth Radio. And we're talking to Tahir Malik of Samad's House and Byron Thompson of The Phoenix. And it's interesting because, like, whenever I interview people and we take our headphones off and we're from the mic, like all, that's when all the stories happen. We should have I should have a segment called after the mic because there's so many interesting like gems that happen in between these periods of time. So PBS, they did a extra special story segment on you. How did that come about?
It came about because of the work that we do in harm reduction. So it's one thing to come into recovery and start rebuilding your life, but then we talk about that community support, that community collection type of wanting to give back to the same community that you once tore down. Yeah. And that's where harm reduction came into play. So Samad's House began an ambassadorship program for our women that successfully completed 120 days with us, but then stayed active within that following 6 months. They became ambassadors for us. Mm-hmm. And an ambassador goes out into the community. And when we started it, this is when we had some really high drug overdose rates. I'm talking about in 2022, over 674 deaths right here in Milwaukee County.
And that was just after the pandemic, or
right after the pandemic.
Pandemic was just,
there was a surge
phasing out. Yeah.
It was a surge because people were feeling that isolation. You know, I'll tell you this.
And they were at home, so you're at home. So what are you going to do?
You're at home.
Yeah.
And you're restricted to your home.
Yeah.
And you are alone. See, I was blessed because my parents lived next door to me.
Yeah.
And my sisters lived upstairs from them, and I was next door. And so our whole family was together. We had our own compound.
Yeah.
So we could come outside and talk to each other, right? But imagine the people who don't have that.
Yep.
That isolation. And then you're all already dealing with mental health issues, right? Mm-hmm. So that compound with substance use kind of sent people spiraling. Mm-hmm. But not only that, there was the fentanyl being put into, you know, the drug supply. Historically, African Americans, especially African American males, are stimulant users.
Yep.
Crack cocaine, powder cocaine. Those are the substances that our community really consume if they're in substance, right? So imagine putting an opioid on that. That's causing heart attacks because that's a speedball effect. You put an opioid on a stimulant, and their body had never had a stimulant. So that caused a surge. And so our ambassadors went into the community to educate and then also to provide naloxone, right? Mm-hmm. Also to provide fentanyl testing strips and seeing how to use those items so that you could save a life, so that you could live another day. And due to all of our harm reduction efforts that we have done over the years, PBS Storied Production in particular, and they're out of San Francisco, the Bay Area, wanted to do a segment because she had lost her brother who was struggling with opioid use. She had lost her brother to addiction.
Yeah.
And she wanted to do a story on someone else who had a similar background and just to tell my story. And so we spoke, and that project took a couple years to come out. Mm-hmm. But it was deeply personal because it wasn't just me. It was my daughter. Yeah. It was to talk. It was helping my daughter talk through what she felt.
Mm.
It's one thing to be in addiction as an adult.
Yeah.
But it's a different component when your daughter is experiencing that and being able to allow her to have the voice of what she felt dealing with a mother in addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And how we could better communicate and how we could also address those abandonment issues that she felt from me due to that.
You know, when you think about like these video series, people put a spotlight on you and you go through like these moments, these ebbs and flows of your life, and you play it on screen, and then you see the rock bottom. It comes through the screen, but it also comes from your mouth. How did your soul like take that?
So, as we were doing it, they wanted to see. Oh my God, this infamous mugshot. Oh my God, and for me, that was deeply personal.
Mm.
Now, I can talk to you all day about me living in addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I can introduce my daughter to be able to speak to her experiences. But when you actually see the depths of what substance use can do to a person,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's a whole different level, right?
Yeah.
But not only to be able to see that, but then to be able to see the bounce back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, society gives up on people mm-hmm. with substance addiction or mental health issue. They give up. They see you on the corner. Mm-hmm. They see you begging and it's, but they don't ever see the true potential of who that person could be or was.
Yep.
And I was one of those people, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was one of those forgotten people. No one knew the potential of what that forgotten person could really add. But see, that was the trial I needed to go through
mm-hmm.
in order to come out of that fire to be able to help. You have to be able to have that compassion, that empathy, to be able to relate to someone who may be at the stage that you once were.
Yeah, that was a super, that movie Coming Home about you that they did was amazing. And it was a short, not a full length movie, it was a short, you know. And, you know, in that, however many short minutes that was, it was just so powerful. And the most powerful part is when you shared the mugshot because you were 365 degrees different from that person that was in that mugshot. And it was so powerful. And for those other women to see that and just see, like, look at this person here. And like, it was shocking. And it was powerful. It was amazing.
Thank you.
Do you think generational trauma trains us to grab relief wherever we can? Like wherever we can find it the fastest, even when we know that, you know, it may cost us later.
Yes, we do. And it don't really stop when you get sober, you know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. you start reaching for something else, you know what I mean? You can. So you really got to check all of that because of your addictive behavior or that need for that fast relief. Just I need relief and that instant gratification. You can find it in, you know, your diet or in your, you know, sex relations or whatever. You'll, you know, hey, but you'll be like, hey, but But I ain't had a drink in 5 years. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You
know what
I mean? Yeah. I ain't had a drink in 5 years, but I'm out here tearing up the world. You know, so you really have to, you know, within yourself find that, you know, this is your triggers and what, you know, what makes you you. And you know, it does run in families, you know, and not my parents or anything like that, but cousins and uncles and stuff like that. I saw it firsthand and definitely had a couple of brothers that was in that life. And
even like noticing, even having a family member in that space, mm-hmm. and you knowing that they're in that space, and then you wind up there, you're like, oh, this is familiar. Oh, I know, you know, this person over here was a part of this life. But, you know, now I'm here, and you're kind of sharing this kind of trauma bond. Right?
Trauma bond for sure. But I think a lot of times when we think of generational curses, if you're a hardhead like me,
yeah,
that doesn't apply to me.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
that is not going to apply to me.
Right.
Right. For me, I felt like I was missing out on something because my parents were so strict. Mm-hmm. I could see family members and cousins, and they get to party, and they get to. It seems like they're having so much fun, and I'm like, well, I want that, right? And then you get grown and you go to college. And now you can experience these things, right? Because you don't have your parents breathing down your neck.
Right.
That's one element. But then it can get out of control. So I went to college and I experienced the partying. Mm-hmm. But by the grace of God, I didn't fall into addiction then, right? I fell into addiction. I had the car accident after I had my first child. But the true essence, and this is, I had such, and I hope he doesn't mind that I share, but I had such a pivotal conversation with my oldest daughter's father more recently.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's not the film festival type guy. Mm-hmm. But I knew that the movie was coming to the Milwaukee Film Festival.
Yeah.
And I said to him, well, you know, I'm going to let you know, the PBS documentary is coming out and it's going to the Milwaukee Film Festival. And I want you to know that there's a segment I have in there about you. And he's like, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, about addiction, my addiction. And he said, well, your addiction came because you got a car accident. And I said, yeah, you're right, the pain. I said, but I ended up liking the effects of those Percocet pills because you left me alone all the time. Mm. I was lonely. You know, I was in love. We talk about what we saw from our parents, those 55 years of marriage.
Yeah.
I was raised that a man comes home to his wife every night. She cooks dinner, they have dinner, and they retire for the night.
Yeah.
But he was a night person. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know how to understand that. That was my first relationship. I didn't know anything about the nightlife.
You were used to your mom being at home by 4 p.m. Like, all right, I'm back at home, or 2 p.m. or home all the time.
I'm telling you, my mother cooked breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Yep.
And we sat down for dinner every day as a family.
Yep.
And we were in the bed by 7. My parents were in the bed by 9, mm-hmm. right? I didn't understand that a man goes out and stay out all night. I didn't understand any of that. That wasn't my background.
Hey, y'all, we're going to come back with this brand new territory. On the grapevine, we got Tahira Malik and Byron Thompson. We'll be back in 2. That beat make you just frown up and then get happy all at the same time. Welcome back to The Grapevine. And we are in the building with Tahira Malik and Byron Thompson. And we're talking sober living. So let's talk numbers for a second. Because Milwaukee needs to hear this clearly. Black residents, and I looked something up, black residents in Milwaukee County are dying from overdoses at nearly double the rate of white residents. And
a little over double.
And despite similar usage rates, when you first saw that number, when you first laid eyes on that number, what went through your mind?
We have to educate and take care of our people so they understand. See, in our communities, we talk a different language.
Yeah.
You know, there's a different language
yeah.
that you speak when you're speaking to a funder.
Yeah.
There's a different language that you speak when you're in a meeting.
Yeah.
But then there's also a different language you have to speak when you're in your community.
Yeah.
So that they understand the detriment of what is happening, right? What did we learn? You have to always be, no, I can't think of the word. So I digress. But for me, it's always to see how many lives we can educate and save.
Mm.
Knowing, you know, a lot of people, when you're out there in a community, they want to say, oh, I don't have a problem. Even though you may think they have a problem. Oh, I don't have a problem. You know, so then you change the strategy and say, you know what? It's not for you. You may happen to see someone who's overdosing.
And
you can save their life.
And just that saying that you don't have a problem may also mean that you have a problem. And it may be bigger than what the problem is. Am I right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think people told me I had a problem a lot before I listened and learned that I did have a problem. You know what I mean? People were just maybe not telling me directly, but telling me in their actions, maybe disassociating with me. You know what I mean? That circle was getting real small, you know, by the time I got, you know, rock bottom. It's like nobody want to mess with me no more, you know. So I only mess with the people who were, like, doing what I was doing, you know.
Yeah.
What happened to the friends? What happened to, you know, nobody want to see you coming and stuff like that. And you know, I mean, I think recovery is about admitting that you have a problem, you know. And sometimes you got to go, unfortunately, you got to really have – go low, you got to really be a hit that bottom before you say, oh, okay. And then everybody's like, yeah, you know, we told you, you know, we were trying to let you know that. But sometimes you're the last to know, you know. And
How many?
Let me also jump in on that. And it may be because you don't want that stigma. Mm. You don't want your family. You know that they're looking at you a certain way, but it's that stigma that's associated to being in addiction.
Yeah. Right.
It's that stigma that you're trying to outrun. Like, no, I don't have a problem, although every sign is showing that you have a problem.
Yes.
No, I'm just tired. Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yeah, I just need a new address. I just need a new job. I just need a new haircut. Mm-hmm. I just need a new shirt. You know,
ain't nobody giving me a chance.
Oh, man. What? So I guess this is maybe an ambiguous question, but probably needs to be answered and solved. I know there are a lot of addictions. And addiction can come in many different forms. So you're not just talking drug addiction also. There are a lot of addictions out here.
Mm-hmm. I discovered that I'm an emotional eater. Yeah. You know, if I'm driving and I hate highway driving, I might snack on some popcorn. Mm. I have to eat something when I'm highly stressed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an addiction because, but I recognize it. So then I have to just figure out how to walk that stuff off.
Sugar.
That sugar.
Sugar.
Yep.
Yeah, I met you in a health space. And I really thought, man, I wish I could be like this guy. You know what I mean? Because
that was drilled into my brain.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Day one.
Yeah. Day one.
You know, because, I mean, that's all part of our community, our history, our sugar, our fried food, our health, our food, you know. And, you know, then put some alcohol and some other stuff on top of that, man. It's really, you know, we got a lot to work on. So I really feel like, I mean, I'm just starting to really tackle the other, you know, addictions. I mean, it's like, hey, look, I got 5 years clean, but I'm growing. My body is growing out here because I'm eating more sweets than, you know, you can tell the person at the AA meeting who got 5 years because they big as a house. You know what I mean? Because they didn't rediscover food. You know what I mean? They might have came in at 90 pounds.
So why is that, though?
That obsessive-compulsive disorder. It's an obsessive-compulsive disorder.
But you're switching from one thing to the next.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
As long as I'm not doing this.
As long as I'm not doing that, you know. And so.
But that's what you realize. Like, I realize that I am an obsessive compulsive person.
Yeah.
I cannot just do one of anything.
Yeah.
I can't just do one of anything. And so I just don't start. But I've kind of switched it because now I work too much. Like, I have to learn how to turn off work.
Yeah.
And that's an addiction in itself. Yep. Because if I'm starting my day at 6:30 and I'm still going at 8 o'clock, that's not healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm not consuming drugs or alcohol, but the way I handle stress is by going into work.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh.
Yeah. So, yeah, definitely all of these addictions, you know, you have to be careful. I mean, I think you have to apply the same principles to whatever got you, you know, sober, your discipline, your, you know, being around. Hey, you know what I mean? You hang around people that probably don't eat what you should be. You know what I mean?
Right,
like,
yeah.
You know, I mean, you got to change. Like I said, you got to change. You know, I'm telling you, I was in a basketball tournament recently, and I can play ball.
Yeah.
And we were all getting ready for the tournament and all that. And then when we got there, I end up rooming with some people who actually kind of played a little at a higher level than I did professionally. Mm-hmm. And man, it was kind of boring, man, because they was eating oatmeal and they were drinking a ton of water. And I was, you know, I was getting my coffee and I, you know, I was sneaking out getting donuts and stuff. You understand? But being around them for a week,
yeah,
you know, enhanced my, you know, I had a great tournament. I had a great, you know, experience because I was hanging around some healthier people.
Right.
And they was, you know, passing around magnesium pills to help you for cramping. And we was drinking extra. I was peeing so much. You understand? So it works in all aspects.
Yeah.
People that you are with.
Yeah.
Your associations, all that works in any addiction that you may have.
You know, there, when coming back to Milwaukee, from Florida, I recognized that the level of addiction that I've seen in people that I once confabbed with over a long period of time, it grew not just in the space of drugs, but it grew in many different forms of their life. And that was the reason why I asked that question, was because how large this thing has grown, especially coming out of the pandemic.
It's just the stressors of life. Mm. People are trying to find ways just to cope with life.
Yeah.
And some of those things aren't the healthiest ways. You know, you're just trying to learn how to cope with life. And I will agree with Byron. And it goes back to what your parents taught you. Be careful of who you befriend.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to be around someone who don't have the best values, because they may bring you down.
Yep. Hey, y'all, when we come back, we're going to get our last closing remarks from Tahira Malik and Byron Thompson. And I got a few rapid fire questions on the grapevine.